So it's my pleasure this evening to welcome Dan Kenner, PhD, acupuncturist, writer and consultant in integrative medicine with 30 years of clinical experience in both Oriental and naturopathic medicine. He's the author of many books, including Core Therapy, Botanical Medicine, and his latest volume, The Whole Body Workbook for Cancer, which is the subject tonight. And we welcome him to the Many Rivers stage for the first time. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here and to see some familiar faces out here, too. This is chairs for me. Usually, I give a little bit more of a formal presentation and have a PowerPoint, and I keep it more conservative because this book is very conservative. Everything that's in here is referenced in the peer-reviewed medical and scientific literature because I wanted to create a book that was very safe for people to show their oncologists, for people to feel like, well, I can do this. This has been tested. It's been researched. And even things like journaling have been researched and found to improve quality of life in cancer patients. And the publisher asked me to do this book, and I wanted to create something that was as useful as possible with not so much storytelling in it. So I'm going to run through and tell you what the book says, more or less, in an oral presentation. But I'm also going to give you the West County version, because we're here in Sebastopol. I'm going to talk a little bit about alternative treatments for cancer as well. Now, we've heard the term CAM, which is complementary and alternative medicine. And so what's the difference? You hear about complementary medicine, alternative medicine. This is complementary medicine. The assumption in writing this book is that 95% of people with a cancer diagnosis will go and the medical route. They'll go see an oncologist, they'll do chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, that type of thing. And so this book is really written with their interests at heart. That's not what I always recommend to people, you know, in my own personal consulting. But complementary means this is a way that you can get, that you can maximize, optimize the treatments that you get from conventional medicine, help with side effects, improve quality of life, and improve longevity. But people who choose alternatives, too, and I've seen people that say, I will absolutely not have any chemotherapy, no radiation, no surgery even sometimes, and I certainly respect that choice, and with some people I encourage it because I think it's the best choice. But even if people choose an alternative, I still recommend that you read the book, because a lot of people that choose alternatives are looking for a magic bullet. And so they're going to find this supplement or that supplement that has that they read about. I believe that everything you read about on the internet, all these cancer cures, supplements, things that have cured arthritis, heart disease, I believe they all work. Everything worked for somebody. I think, you know, there are frauds and charlatans everywhere. But to me, the real science is what worked for whom and why. No one's in a position to say this doesn't work. So, but people have the mentality that I'm going to find the cure. Well, it's not that simple. The cure is a process, and it's a complex process. So, let's see, I've got my notes here. One of the purposes of this book is to heal helplessness. If you get a diagnosis of heart disease, the doctor will sit you down and say, now, Fred, Jane, wherever you are, you've got to change your diet. You got to take care of stress. You need to get more exercise. Let's take care of this. You know, get out there and do what you need to do. You get a diagnosis of diabetes. Now, Fred or Jane, sit down here. Here's how you need to change your diet. You need to get more exercise. You need to manage stress better. And I'm going to show you how to inject yourself in the leg. But if you have a cancer diagnosis, they'll say, eat anything you want. Don't take any supplements. We're going to take care of it. So cancer patients feel helpless. What can you do? Well, the fact is there's a lot that you can do. But the first thing, now that I've explained there are no magic bullets, I want to talk about four conditions that promote cancer development. As frightening as the word cancer is, we produce cancer cells every day by the hundreds, even by the thousands. All living organisms do. We produce defective cells. The body breaks them down, eliminates them. But there are certain conditions that prevent the body from eliminating them. There are certain conditions that allow them to stay in the body and even to stick and even to proliferate and even to move around the body. The first one is called oxidative stress. Oxidative, we have all heard of antioxidants because now it's become a promotional term for lots of supplements. All the vitamins are antioxidant, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E. In general, the vegetable kingdom is antioxidant, so a diet high in vegetables and fruits is an antioxidant diet. The entire vegetable kingdom, as it happens, exhales oxygen, so they have strong antioxidant properties. We all have an antioxidant system in the cell that prevents damage to the cell structures by oxygen. And actually, oxidative stress is caused by oxygenation of the cells being inefficient as we get older. Anyway, oxidative stress creates conditions that lead to more rapid aging, and also the creation of free radicals and different products that can damage the cell. So oxidative stress is one of the things that can prevent cancer cells from being eliminated. The second is inflammation. A non-resolving inflammatory process creates chemical byproducts that prevent cells from dying their natural death. This is called apoptosis. And the inflammatory byproducts can prevent apoptosis so that cells have eternal life, in essence. They keep growing, they don't die. Likewise, the byproducts of cancer growth can promote inflammation, so it becomes a type of self-promoting cycle, a vicious circle, as it were. The third condition that promotes cancer growth is glycation, which basically means too much sugar in the diet, or too high a glycemic diet. But sugar in particular has been known to be cancer fuel for decades. It's called glycation.
Glycation.
Yeah, G-L-I-C-A-T-I-O-N. So glycation is the process of protein damage by simple sugars is how you define glycation. And this is caused by too much sugar in the diet. Cancer cells live on sugar. They are a type of anaerobic life. They also burn a lot of sugar, and this is how you can tell if cancer cells are growing or not. This is how you can detect them with what's called a PET scan. A PET scan is a type of medical imaging that shows glucose metabolism. So there's a lot of intense glucose metabolism in malignant tumors, and this is what the PET scan picks up. We also know that this high sugar diet that tumor cells seem to like creates a lot of lactic acid. And then the lactic acid creates the type of cellular environment that promotes inflammation and promotes further growth. So here we have another vicious circle.
Would this be food sugar as well, or just cane?
Yeah, simple sugars. High glycemic would include even white rice and potatoes, things like that. Although I'm not going to go so far to say that eating potatoes and white rice is going to cause cancer, but if you have in general a high glycemic diet, that's going to contribute to cancer cell proliferation. And then the fourth condition is low immunity. One of the important ways that cancer cells are controlled is there are different types of white cells. White blood cells are important agents of the immune system. There are two types of cells that are called killer cells. One is called the natural killer cell, or NK for short. Then there are the LAK cells, lymphokine-activated killer cells. These killer cells don't need an antigen. They can spot something that doesn't belong there. So if you have a virus-infected cell, if you have a malignant cell, the NK cells, for example, will attach themselves to it, inject it with granules, and blow it up. Then another type of white cell called the macrophage, which means the big eater, comes along and gobbles up all the debris and breaks it down. So the abnormal cells get exploded and then broken down into smaller components that are non-irritating and easily eliminated by the body. Now, natural killer cells are interesting for a couple of reasons. Well, one reason I already told you, they don't need an antigen. They're very nonspecific. Another reason is that they are very much a mind-body link. People who have studied and created actually the science of psychoneuroimmunology, which is now sometimes called psychoneuroendocrinology, endocrinoimmunology, is a blending of what were once separate disciplines. And the psychoneuroimmunologists are saying that a white blood cell is like a circulating brain cell, and that the mind and the immune system are very closely linked. Well, as it happens, research on stress that has been carried out over the last 20 or 30 years has shown unequivocally that stress affects the immune system. We've known since the 1930s that stress affects the endocrine system, the whole flight or fight response and that type of thing. There are a number of ways that stress affects the immune system, but one thing seems to always happen, and that's that NK cells become sluggish. You may have the same number of them. There may be just as many of them as before, but their activity diminishes. So a malignant cell can go sliding by, and the NK cell will just sit there, sluggish, and not do anything. Now, all kinds of stress seem to do this. Everything from self-criticism, divorce, Hurricane Andrew, the great Los Angeles earthquake, all of these things have been studied on their effects on the immune system, and they've all been shown to make NK cell activity sluggish. Just a second. Sugar slows down NK cell activity. Lack of exercise slows down NK cell activity. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So when NK cell activity becomes sluggish, even though you may have just as many of these white cells, they're not doing their job. On the other hand, there is some Japanese research that has shown that music therapy increases NK cell activity. Positive thoughts, positive self-imaging, positive talking to yourself increases NK cell activity. Different supplements, B vitamins, things like that, increase NK cell activity. So there are supplements that you can take for that as well, but at the root of it is having a positive attitude and having positive action in your life. So those are the four main things that promote cancer development. And so everything that's in the book speaks in terms of this is anti-inflammatory, or this is antioxidant, or this increases immunity. For example, there are studies that show that exercise reduces inflammation. There are studies that show that exercise reduces depression. There are studies that show that various supplements will increase NK cell activity. And there are different foods that are anti-inflammatory. And you know, of course, all the vegetables are antioxidant, but turmeric has been studied extensively. That's the herb that's in curry powder that makes it yellow. It's used in Ayurvedic medicine. It's used in Chinese medicine for liver drainage. It has a powerful anti-inflammatory effect, an antioxidant effect. Green tea, and particularly some of the components in green tea, also have antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects. And by the same token, they have anti-cancer effects, preventive effects. Now, if you've ever had cancer, it can be an obsession to have it never come back again. And so this is important because if you follow strategies that are in this book, you can become more confident in your health, and you can become more confident that you will be aware if anything is going on, that you'll have an intuitive sense that something is not right. So I want to talk about the seven components of the healing process as I have them laid out in the book. The first is detoxification. Now, detoxification means a lot of things to a lot of people. And probably to most Americans, detoxification means the Betty Ford Clinic. It means you're on heavy drugs and you're getting off of them. Well, that's one level of detoxification. What I call the first level of detoxification is to get off the popular drugs, coffee, sugar, and alcohol. I'm not saying don't use coffee, don't use alcohol, don't have sweets. I'm saying don't be addicted. There's a huge difference. You can't enjoy them anymore when you're addicted. So stage one detoxification means get off the drugs. If you have to have it every day, you're addicted. It's as simple as that. And the most difficult one probably to get off of is sugar. There was a study done in France about 3 years ago that showed that sugar is more addictive than cocaine. And this was a controlled study that was reported in medical journals that sugar was about three times as addictive as cocaine. And they're talking about, they compare this to crack cocaine addicts. I would say that that's a very modest claim, because crack cocaine, it has a hideous reputation in the polite world, whereas sugar is something we give to children to make them happier, to shut them up. Sugar is very socially acceptable. Some people have it after every meal. So how much more addictive does that make it to have it as socially acceptable as it is, compared to something that you've got to go to the darker parts of town to purchase and hide from every human that you know, except maybe a fellow addict. So detox, that's the first level of detox. The next level of detox is to identify any foods that you might be allergic to, or that you might be intolerant of. And there are different degrees of that. There are some things you may be out and out allergic to, your throat tightens up, give me a shot of adrenaline, get me to the emergency room. There are other things that may just cause your neck to tighten up and you feel a little bit fuzzy for a while, and that's something that you may not be allergic to, but you may be intolerant of. Well, it's tricky business to figure this out, but the main detox strategy that's in this book is what I call the 5-day diet, which is a simple elimination diet where for 5 days you have a simple diet of steamed vegetables, salads, and no animal protein, and no dairy product, including dairy products. And, of course, the coffee, sugar, and alcohol are off the list. And nothing that the liver would have to work on. All we're doing is giving the liver a rest for 5 days. The liver is kind of the root. Liver intolerance is at the root of many food allergies. And the way food allergies are often treated in natural medicine is to restore the liver's ability to tolerate certain proteins and metabolize them. If you're intolerant of a food or allergic to it, it seldom gets better just by avoiding it. Usually you have to go a step further. So the next level of detoxification would be a 5-day diet in which you have steamed vegetables, salads, and if you're ambitious, get a juicer and have freshly juiced vegetable juices a couple of times a day. And if you have sugar cravings or if you're still hungry, for most people that'll help take care of it. Freshly juiced, because we want all the enzymes in it. For about 20-25 minutes, it's still alive, and then the enzyme activity starts to fade. So you can't just buy a quart of commercial juice and expect the same thing. You'll still get nutrients, but you won't get the same effect, and you won't get the same satisfaction. Now, detox goes much further than this, and I'll be talking about that when I get into talking about when I get into the West County portion of this, where we're talking about the alternatives. But the next component is diet. And, you know, diet reform and detox are pretty much parallel in this book, because I'm asking people to simplify their diet. If you have an active cancer threat, if you're actively dealing with cancer, then you want to get a diet that works really well for you and stick with it and try not to go off of it. If you're experimenting, you do the diet for 5 days, then you go off of it, and you have meat, you have ice cream, you have anything you've been craving especially, you have it, and then you learn what your body wants to do with it. So back to detox for a minute. You can't lose if you do that, because you may find, for example, that I've had people do the 5-day diet, and then when they go off of it, they'll say, I want a candy bar. I'll go get a candy bar. Sinus allergies are back in a tenth of a second. It's almost before it even gets into the blood. It's amazing things can happen. But on the other hand, you could at the end of 5 days, I want some ice cream, I miss my ice cream. At the end of 5 days, go have your ice cream. First thing, do not pass go. Get it right now. Well, you could have the best tasting, most enhanced, wonderful, divine ice cream experience you've ever had in your life. That's good. Enjoy yourself. You can also find, you know, one or two bites, that does the trick. I don't need to eat the whole pint of Haagen-Dazs. One or two bites and I'm satisfied. So one advantage of the five-day diet is you can be satisfied with less. No one needs to eat slabs of meat. You know, meat used traditionally as a condiment, small amounts of it. You know, look at the classic pork and beans. You got this many beans and a little chunk of pork. So salt cod, salt pork, all these things were small quantities of animal protein for flavoring and to round out the beans and the grains and the staples of the diet. So the detoxification and the diet components are pretty close to offering the same thing. The diet portion of this book will give more information about different foods that are anti-inflammatory and antioxidant and immune system boosting. For example, a lot of the mushrooms like shiitake, reishi are immune system boosting. And I mentioned turmeric and green tea, but there's also ginger and garlic, and the crucifers, which is the cabbage family, are anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, and they have beneficial hormonal properties also for some types of cancers. So detoxification and diet are two very important components of healing. I'm going to talk about the next one being supplements because it's a part of diet. We don't always get everything we need with our diet. And for example, if someone is faced with a prostate issue, they may need zinc. Or they may have too much zinc. There are different ways of finding this out. But in general, if it's a malignancy in the prostate, there's an insufficiency of zinc. And you've got to eat a lot of oysters to get the amount of zinc that you would need. So sometimes supplementation is useful. Vitamin E, vitamin A supplementation is useful. In some of the European cancer therapies, they give you beta carotene until your skin turns orange. Beta carotene is one of the carotenes that's found in carrots, beets, and a number of the other, you know, green and yellow yellow and orange vegetables. So supplementation is sometimes necessary. And then there are some supplements that have been tested extensively with cancer treatment. And I'll tell you briefly about two of them. One of them is called AHCC. It's developed in Japan. It's made from a shiitake, and I think hybridized with another mushroom or two. They take the mycelium, which is the root-like hairy threads of the mushroom. They don't grow it into a mushroom. They take the root-like threads and culture it in rice bran, which is another food, for a few weeks, and then they pull out the mycelial threads and culture it for 6 weeks in a liquid bath. And during this time, very powerful immune factors are created. Not only that, but some of the immune system boosting nutrients in mushrooms are very large molecules, like beta-glucan. It's a huge molecule, very difficult to absorb and to utilize. But the fermentation process breaks things down into tiny molecules that'll slurp right through the membranes and get right into the blood and the lymph system, even if there's an impaired digestion. In other words, they're pre-digested. So that's why soybeans, no, miso, yes. And cabbage is good, but during the winter, fermented sauerkraut is even better because it's full of bacteria and enzymes. So the AHCC benefits from the fermentation process by creating new immune-boosting chemicals that are not in the mushroom itself and that are very tiny molecules that are very bioavailable. Now, AHCC is used in over 700 clinics and hospitals in Japan to protect the immune system from the side effects of chemotherapy and radiation. So when patients take AHCC, it protects the bone marrow. A lot of people don't die of cancer. They die because chemotherapy destroyed the bone marrow, so the red cell count goes down. They become anemic and tired. The white cell count goes down, so you catch a cold, and it's pneumonia in days, and you're dead because there's no resistance to it. AHCC protects the bone marrow. Some patients don't even lose their hair during chemotherapy. And it's been tested and tested and tested in Japan, China. They've tested it in MD Anderson here at Yale University, at UC Davis. So it's very safe, and it's used with chemotherapy routinely. And in some cases, it's been used as a standalone treatment for cancer. I don't recommend that. But it's always safe to use. Another one is made from wheat germ. wheat germ is already a health food, but when you culture it, it produces chemicals called benzoquinones that have known anti-cancer properties. The Nobel Prize-winning scientist, Zentgiorgi, who was the discoverer of vitamin C, was doing research on wheat germ and culturing it back in the 1960s, and his research ended. But in the 90s, some people picked it up and said, this is cool stuff, let's work on this. So what happened was they got very good initial results, and one of the Hungarian doctors was praying. He prayed to God and says, Mary, Mother of God, I have something here that can help people throughout the world cure their cancer. I need some way to be able to develop this further. And the next day, a man came in and said, well, I don't know exactly why I'm here, but someone told me I should come here, and I'm an investor, and I'm looking for a project. And so, because his prayer was answered, he called the product Avemar, after Ave Maria. So Avemar is available. It's a cultured product like AHCC made from wheat germ. It's been tested with melanoma patients to improve quality of life. It's been tested with lung cancer patients. It's been tested with pediatric leukemia cancer patients. Children are at high risk of dying because of what's called febrile neutropenia, which means that a type of white blood cell goes down because of chemotherapy. Children get a fever, an infection, they die very quickly. Well, Avemar cut febrile neutropenia in half and even down lower in some studies. So it's something that's saved a lot of children's lives by protecting their immune system from chemotherapy. So those are a couple. There's also astragalus, which has been used in China since the 70s to protect the immune system from chemotherapy. There's ginseng. And then there are some of the vitamins, vitamin C, vitamin E. So supplementation is part of diet. The next and equally important component of the healing process is exercise. Now, some people are really good with this. They exercise, and they're fit, they're robust. But I've worked with a lot of athletes, and many of them are sugar addicts. They like that fast-burning fuel. And they demineralize, and they get injuries. They start saying, what's wrong? You know, and they don't want to stop when they get injured. They want to keep it up. They're like, well, can I use half weight on my sprained elbow, or can I just do half the number of reps on it? Says, no, nothing. 6 weeks. Stop cold. Athletes don't like to hear that. But if you can get athletes off of sugar, then they'll become instantly much more healthy. So what I'm getting at saying is that a lot of people have a weak link, and that's why this is a workbook. In the 7 chapters about the components of the healing process is a little questionnaire to help you decide if this is your weak link. Now, I frankly confess my weak link in the book is being exercise. I don't like to exercise, but when I do, I feel really good. The benefits are profound. Exercise is a cure for depression. It's a cure for inflammation. It stimulates endorphins. You know, the second wind. You know, the runner's high, that's endorphins. You reach a point where, oh, I can't go another step. But you go another step anyway, and like, woo, second wind. And you zoom off, you know, and the endorphins go off. And you feel, on top of the world, at the mountaintop. So it's good for creating endorphins. And by the same token, it increases the NK cell activity, our immunity. And it lowers the stress hormones like cortisol. So there are some studies in here that show the benefits of exercise and some very pointed questions to see if you're actually getting enough of it. The fifth component of the healing process I call generically lifestyle. Lifestyle in this context has nothing to do with your sexuality or anything else. It has to do with what have you got in your medicine cabinet, in your cleaning closet, in your garage? What are you spraying on your garden? How much do you use a cell phone? It's all the exposures, the environmental exposures, that can cause cancer. when I do a more formal presentation, I've got all my numbers. I don't remember how many 100,000 chemicals there are that have never been tested for safety, that are legally used out in the environment. But out of the 9,000 or so that have been tested, about 95% of them have found to be carcinogenic. You could count on one hand the number of chemicals that are out there, synthetic chemicals that are safe, that are not carcinogenic. So there's this risk. The first thing to do, and there's a little table with some chemical names, look for what's in your house to start with, or what might be out in your yard. And be aware that places like golf courses and public parks are full of pesticides and herbicides. And if you go to a park or a golf course when there's spraying water and everything, well, this stuff is probably in the air. And you can walk through and breathe some of this spray and take in herbicides, pesticides, and they contain arsenic, lead. This is one way people get heavy metals, you know, and they're not aware of how could I have gotten these heavy metals. We know where mercury comes from. There's a lot of places it comes from. You know, coal-fired power plants puts mercury in the air. Dental mercury can't get in a thermometer, but they can still put it in your teeth, you know. Go figure. The chemical companies can really do whatever they want, so it's important to know that and to avoid what hazards you can. Then there are also the electromagnetic hazards and being aware of them. So the lifestyle chapter is about a laundry list of hazards for you to look for in your home environment and your work environment. This brings us to components 6 and 7, emotional healing and psycho-spiritual healing. Now, what's the difference? And it's important to make a distinction here because, to me, emotional healing is finding trauma, relieving trauma in your life. And this is often the biggest missing link. This is the one that gets ignored the most. Because you may have been abused as a child, sexually, verbally, physically, or, you know, it may have been years ago in your teens or your 20s and you had some kind of shock or a trauma. It could have been a car accident. It doesn't have to be anybody's fault. But there's a tendency to say, oh, that happened a long time ago. I'm over that. I think I've processed that. I've done 5 years of psychotherapy. Well, are you really so sure? And if you're faced with a serious health threat, it's time to look at that again. And there are some strategies and ways to look at that. It's called PTSD, for short, post-traumatic stress disorder. We know from some of the NK cell studies that a trauma can lower NK cell activity for as long as 4 or 5 years. The studies haven't gone beyond that, but we also know that in chronic fatigue syndrome, the time of onset of chronic fatigue syndrome is quite often in the mid-30s. And the rate of childhood abuse, when you're 3 years old, 4 years old, and chronic fatigue syndrome onset in one's 30s is extremely high, and there's considered to be a correlation. Maybe even a cause-effect, but at least a correlation. There's a history of trauma. It's a history of abuse. And not that low immunity is the only factor that's possible, but low immunity is almost always there. So this is what's meant by emotional healing. And I'll be talking about alternatives a little bit. I want to talk about the emotional healing more because there's one alternative cancer therapy that's built almost entirely around finding that trauma, identifying it and processing it. Number 7, psycho-spiritual healing. This is where we deal with existential issues, the meaning of life, life and death, metaphysical issues. It's where we want to, if we want to live on, we're being asked when our mortality is right in our face to seek our authentic self and escape the personality. Something like a cancer diagnosis is a trauma. I call it medical trauma. But if you think in terms of what the Gurdjieff teachings, it strips away the buffers. We all know we're going to die. Everybody knows that. But we know it in a way that's very insulated from our day-to-day experience. Sometimes people who had a trauma will wake up in the middle of the night with that intense awareness of death. Or people who had a close call with death, you know, will have that sense of their mortality. But a cancer diagnosis really drives it home. Even though, you know, you may live 5 years, 10 years, you have your mortality in your face. And so there are strategies for that that I'm sure all of you know. Things like meditation, vision quest, different types of mindfulness exercises, prayer. For all the Christians in the readership audience across the country, there are resources for Christian meditation. Meditation is mentioned in the Bible a number of times. And so in the book, I try to escape the stereotype that meditation is a very Hindu sort of thing or a Buddhist type of thing. So those are the seven components of the healing process. And in each chapter, I try to give good medically tested reasons why people should explore these, why you should look through the questionnaire and try to find where you might have a weak link. Because if you miss something important, you can exercise, do this wonderful diet, you can do all the supplements, you can do all the right things right down the line, but if you're sitting on top of a serious abuse, you may still be fighting an uphill battle. You may still never quite get that feeling of like, I'm in the driver's seat with my life. I can't control life and death, but I know my true self, I know my mind, and I respect myself enough to grow it. I'm here to grow my spirit, to grow my soul, and I know how to do it, and I know what that feels like. That's where we want to be. Now, I worked with a number of people who have said they absolutely would not ever consider conventional cancer treatment. And like I said, I respect that decision. Interestingly enough, a lot of the people who say that are people who are medically trained. And in fact, some of the doctors I know in Europe that use alternative methods for treating cancer say, oh yeah, I get a lot of doctors or their wives. They come in after hours and they close the blinds. And we discuss it. I know of a doctor in Germany that's treated a number, in Switzerland, that's treated a number of Americans. There's an exodus of people going to Europe and to Mexico for alternative cancer treatment. Some of them have been people who are high up in the FDA. We tend to think there's a cultural divide that the bureaucrats, you know, well, they're very left-brained. They don't understand alternative health care. When you're faced with a cancer diagnosis, you start to understand a lot. You expand your scope greatly. And so people who are looking for real answers often look for alternatives. So as it happens, and I view this as a karmic thing, I was asked to do this book based on some articles and things that I had written, and the publisher asked me if I wanted to do a book. And of course I said yes. Within a year, a friend of mine in France, who's an acquisitions consultant for a French publisher, said, Dan, how would you like to do a book for us? I said, I'd love to do a book for you. And he said, I said, what are you interested in? And he said, well, something about cancer would be good. And so here it is again, you know, it's like, why me? And so I sent him some of this material, and he came back and said, no, we've got all that. You know, we don't need that. What have you got that's you know, more progressive-minded? So I said, okay, well, I'm going to write a book about alternatives cancer, and it will come out in France at the end of this year. It'll probably be in print by the end of the year, and they'll launch it maybe next spring. And I think the working title is The Science of Natural Cancer Therapy. But I'm going to run through some of that material for this particular esteemed audience. I have alternative cancer therapies, 7 or 8 here, divided into different categories. The first category I call the hypometabolic toxemia model. Hypometabolic means the metabolism is sluggish and there is toxic material. Now, if your metabolism is sluggish, toxic material will accumulate anyway because the thyroid activity and the liver activity are sluggish, which means that things that are not metabolized by the liver and thyroid system precipitate. They end up in the connective tissue. And the connective tissue is part of the immune system. It's called the reticuloendothelial system. And the mucous membranes are part of the immune system. The thymus, endocrine gland, is part of the immune system. the brain, central nervous system, part of the immune system, the bone marrow and the white cells, it's all, the immune system pervades the body. And when metabolism is low, immunity is low, and what happens is that things are deposited. So I want to talk briefly before I get further into that about the six stages of disease. Because we tend to think of disease as being a thing. You know, I had a cold and then it went away, the disease is gone. But disease should properly be thought of as a vector or as a process that goes on throughout your life. Let me illustrate. Suppose you have tonsillitis. Well, the tonsils are inflamed. You might have streptococcus infection. That's a disease. So it can kill the streptococcus or it can take the tonsils out and the disease is over. Suppose we take the tonsils out and 10 years later someone has lupus. Well, from the German biological medicine school of thought, that's considered to be a consequence of removing the tonsils, that this very important first line of defense in the immune system has been removed, so secondary mechanisms have to take over. And so-called autoimmune diseases are almost all in people who have had tonsillectomies, adenoidectomies, or people with leaky gut syndrome. There's either a digestive factor or what's called a lymphatic ring. So autoimmunity, simply autoimmunity in conventional medicine means that the immune system goes insane and starts attacking healthy tissues. Well, the natural medicine viewpoint is the immune system is, the body never goes insane. You know, the divine vital force that created this out of a single-celled creature is smarter than we are. What happens is that tissues become toxic with stuff. Large molecules leak through when the intestine is like a sieve. Large molecules don't get processed because major lymph nodes are gone. And so the immune system is simply trying to break this stuff down with the same enzymes that it uses in the digestive tract, just trying to finish digesting things wherever they happen to fall. So in this vector of disease, the first stage is called the excretion stage. That's the mucous membranes. If there's a toxic threat to the body, we throw up or we have diarrhea or we sweat, but the body clears it out, and then it's all gone. It's not really a disease from a natural medicine point of view. It's just normal immune system function. Runny nose, you know, clears it all out. Diarrhea clears it all out. You know, the drainage occurs, and then the threat's gone. If this doesn't resolve the problem, the next phase is called the inflammatory phase. This is every itis. In the inflammatory phase, the excretion is not enough, so the liver and the thyroid gland oxidize it. They burn it up, and they raise the body temperature, or they create local inflammation or heat, and it burns it up. And then it's gone. So the internal cellular environment is still protected. The third stage phase, though, is called the deposition phase. If it's not excreted, if the immune system doesn't take care of it, it starts to deposit in the mucous membranes, particularly. So this is like allergies. Allergies, some of it starts to infiltrate the mucous membranes, and inflammation, sneezing and heat and burning sinuses, and a runny nose and all that aren't enough to get it out. So it's starting to stick a little bit. Those are what they call the humoral phases, meaning it's still in the fluid system. It's still in what's called the Th2 phase of immunity, which is the called the humoral immunity. The last three stages are when it starts to get in deeper. So when metabolic waste that is not excreted, not burned off, that's depositing, but burrowing in a little bit further, that's called the infiltration stage. And that's when you get autoimmunity, that's when you get arthritis, that's when you get polyps and cysts and things like that. And it leads to the fifth stage, which is called the degenerative stage. Okay, at this, up until stage four, the fluids have been protected. So the cellular environment is bathed in lymph fluid and tissue fluid, and it gets its nutrients and carries away the waste. But when that gets compromised, starts getting cruddy in there, starts getting viscous, so it's not circulating very well, the nutrients don't get to the cells very easily. And the waste products don't clear out, so they create even more congestion. At this point, cells start to rupture, and the cytoplasm starts to leak out. Now, the cytoplasm is where the RNA is. So this is like a viral stage of illness, and this is when tissues and organs start to degenerate, like a chronic viral infection. And some autoimmune diseases are also reach this stage. This is when cell groups and tissues are being destroyed. And the final stage is called neoplasm. Neoplasm is when the cell integrity gets down to the nucleus of the cell. It's where the DNA is. The DNA is released, and DNA creates life. So it goes into this mess and creates new life. And it's a process of creating, of new birth, creating new life. And actually, fetal proteins are created and causing cancer. There's a whole list of them. Well, a famous one is alpha fetal protein, or AFP, which is used to diagnose liver cancer. Well, these fetal proteins can be a male or a female. There's no baby being grown here, but this fetal protein is being produced by the DNA that's leaking out of the interior of cells that have been damaged by this crudded up environment. Now, conventional cancer therapy goes after the tumor. Oh, you got a tumor. Get the tumor, get the tumor. Get our most vicious, horrible chemicals, get atomic power, get rid of the tumor. Well, the tumor is a compensation mechanism. The tumor is a product of the whole metabolic condition. You'll never be cured until you correct that. Take the tumor out, you can also make a big mess. It is now well established that cancer surgery can provoke metastasis. This is preventable. But it was known ever since the early 1990s. They found this, where was it, in Germany? University of Frankfurt. They found that cancer surgery reliably promoted metastasis. Well, now that the research has been done here, it's legitimate, so it's considered to be a risk factor. Now, why would surgery promote metastasis? Is that for me to stop? Okay. Good. I'm just getting warmed up. One reason that surgery would promote metastasis is because of inflammation would go way up, right? It'd be normal. You make an incision, there's going to be inflammation because inflammation is a healing process. But all those inflammatory byproducts will promote cancer growth in other parts of the body. So if we could bring that inflammation down, we can possibly prevent the metastasis. So cancer is more than a tumor. It's produced by a metabolic condition. The metabolic condition needs to be corrected. And there are a number of ways of doing that. And so back to the hypometabolic toxemia model. One was discovered by a doctor named Max Gerson, who began his healing program in the 1920s because he had disabling migraine headaches and was spending about 3 days a week in bed. Gerson discovered that he had a food allergy, and when he went on a very simple diet, he found that his headaches went away and he was able to function and live normally. So he began doing this with his migraine patients that came in, and it worked very well. But it also seemed to work really well for lupus patients and tuberculosis patients. And by the mid-1930s, he published 8 cases of left-for-dead pulmonary tuberculosis cases that were completely healed. He published this in a peer-reviewed German medical journal. He treated Albert Schweitzer for diabetes. Albert Schweitzer said, "This man is the preeminent medical genius of our age." He treated Albert Schweitzer's wife for pulmonary tuberculosis. She got well in 1 year, healthy, pink, rosy-cheeked. Well, as the National Socialists gained power, Gerson was forced to leave and he came to America. And by this time, he was treating cancer patients. And his regimen had grown to a diet, a very simple diet of vegetables that are cooked at low temperature, simmered so as not to just cook them to death. and then several freshly juiced juices during the day, and a regimen of caffeine retention enemas, as many as 5 or 6 a day. He found when he began treating cancer patients that he put them on the diet, and some of them would just die of liver failure because the liver would get overloaded. But the caffeine retention enema is to keep the liver and bile ducts moving material through. Florence Nightingale was part of discovering the coffee enema. They were giving them to soldiers who had pain from amputations and shrapnel wounds and all that. And just for fun, some of the nurses would put coffee in their enemas, you know, room temperature coffee, and it was just kind of to, you know, raise the morale. Thought, hey, they'll feel better. We'll, you know, give them a boost, give them a lift, but the pain would go away. And so it became part of standard practice, and it was in the Merck Manual of Standard Practice until 1974. So Gerson used it to keep his cancer patients from dying. The liver would get overloaded and they'd die of metabolic acidosis. So by the time he came to America, he was treating a lot of cancer patients. He was saying very unpopular things like tobacco smoking causes cancer. Cancer patients should not be drinking Jim Beam after work. Things like that. This is back when the Journal of the American Medical Association would have doctors taking a lucky strike break, you know, with their stethoscopes around their neck, you know, and chatting together and that kind of thing. So Gerson was marginalized. He was an outcast. He was considered a nutcase, but he was tolerated because he was a genius. He was an immigrant, you know, part of the whole wave that brought over Einstein and all these other, brain people. Gerson was trained at some of the top institutions in Germany back when doctors from all over the world went to Germany to get the best education. And his dietary ideas were being used in hospitals and institutions over there in the 1920s and 1930s. This was not fringe kind of stuff. There was a golden age of medicine from 1900s until about the mid-1930s in natural therapies. Anyway, Gerson was in upstate New York treating cancer patients. Very simple diet. Juices, thyroid supplementation, which included thyroid, Armour thyroid, niacin, and Lugol's solution, which is an iodine supplement. Small amounts of animal protein, a fermented product called cork, which is sort of a type of yogurt, kind of a cottage cheese, and also crude liver from calf's liver, which would be juiced, injected, taken orally in gel caps, and plus exercise, walking every day, fresh air, getting out in the sunshine. There were some other elements to it, and people were getting well. As soon as Gerson died, the Gerson Institute moved offshore. So they went to Mexico and stayed there along with some of the other successful natural cancer therapies. So when Gerson died, basically the method stopped cold. And there was a doctor named William Donald Kelly, who is actually a dentist, who had pancreatic cancer and cured himself with the Gerson program. But when his wife had some mysterious type of cancer, she wasn't responding. She did pretty well after a while. And just in hysterical desperation, he gave her some raw meat. And that brought her back. So he found out, we've got body types here. We need to individualize the treatment a little bit. And so he developed a cancer therapy. They put a strong emphasis on using proteolytic enzymes, which was part of Gerson's therapy, but he made maximum use of lots of proteolytic enzymes. Proteolytic enzymes do several things. One is they eat away at the outer shell of a solid tumor and expose it to the immune system. The immune system is fooled when it comes to a tumor. Tumor says, nobody in here but us chickens. But the actual outer shell has antibodies, antigens that say, no, we're normal tissue, we're fine, thank you for coming, but everything is in order here. Well, if you eat that away, then there's the malignancy and the immune system can get to it. The other thing that it does is that it reduces inflammation. And it reduces inflammation not by suppressing it. but by accelerating what inflammation is trying to do in the first place, which is to break down necrotic proteins. If you tear your shoulder or you have a soft tissue injury, you've torn tissue. Tissue is made of protein. So the body comes along with proteolytic enzymes and breaks down the torn tissue, liquefies it. That gives you swelling, that gives you heat, and then it drains away. But as we get older, that process does not resolve thoroughly. We have fewer enzymes, we have more congestion. If we add in enzymes from the outside, we're helping the body resolve what it can't resolve with its own resources. And proteolytic enzymes are like bromelain from noni juice or pineapple juice, papayan, which is from papaya. And Gerson used pancreatin from sheep pancreas. But there are different products that combine these. So in Kelly's program, it was Gerson with more individualized diet and lots more of the enzymes. And he had tremendous success, helped literally thousands of people. And he was down in Texas, and he retired. But before he retired, in his latter years, he was considered a fraud and a quack, of course, you know, total nutcase. A young doctor named Nicholas Gonzalez was doing a research project and wanted to basically expose Kelly, show that, you know, what Kelly's doing, why Kelly's program can't work, that kind of thing. He and Kelly met in New York. Kelly said, I'd love for my life's work to be validated, and I invite you to come down. I'll give you everything. He kept meticulous records. He gave Gonzalez all of his records, and Gonzalez personally interviewed a couple of hundred of Kelly's patients, and he wrote 50 of them up in complete detail. And Gonzalez said, I'll be damned. This works. This guy's for real. What he was doing has been a successful cancer treatment. So, and Gonzalez, you know, he had some real high-up academic supervisors, you know, that said, go for it, you know, this is good, you know. This. So he staked his reputation on it and published he endured his own harassment and everything, but he has published pancreatic cancer cases that show that his method dramatically increases longevity in people with late-stage pancreatic cancer. Late-stage pancreatic cancer is a matter of weeks, not months. And he's got years. And back to Gerson for a second, there are two women with malignant melanoma that were told they have weeks to live that both independently wrote an autobiography. One of them is named Beata Bishop. She's still alive in London. She wrote her book, I think, 25 or 30 years ago. Had very late stage melanoma, had been carved to pieces where they cut it all out of the skin. Still alive. She regenerated herself. This is regeneration medicine. So this I could consider a continuum. Gerson, Kelly, Gonzalez is this school of thought of raising thyroid metabolic activity and cleansing the connective tissue and regenerating the liver. The liver will regenerate itself. Even cirrhosis will regenerate itself. I didn't know that till a couple of years ago when I saw x-ray proof that cirrhotic lesions could go away. In this category, there's one more unrelated method called Coley's fluid, C-O-L-E-Y, Coley. William Coley was a 19th century. There were no immunologists. There was no immunology then. But he's considered the father of immunology, and there are even awards that are in his name. He was not a nutcase. He was not a marginal figure. He was renowned, well-respected. And he noticed that when cancer patients, tumors all over the place, caught what they called erysipelas, which is actually a bacterial infection, often streptococcus or staphylococcus, they get a raging fever and the cancer would go away. All gone, clean as a whistle. And after seeing that a few times, I thought, damn, that's good. So he created a lysate, took the bacteria, and removed some of the fever-inducing compounds, and they were called Coley's toxins, and he began introducing the cancer patients. And he's a scientist. These were written up. These were published. And by 1930, Park Davis had control of it, and it was being used in mainstream medicine, but then eventually it stopped. When the Second World War came, a lot of things stopped cold, and it became a whole new era of medicine and industry and agriculture and everything. But Coley's toxins were still considered to be a medicine, and several doctors tried to revitalize the research in the 1970s and were told, well, you've got to jump through all the same flaming hoops that a new drug has to go through because it just hasn't been used in a while. So there are doctors that are doing this. There's research going on in British Columbia. They call it Coley's fluid now. He says we can control the fevers and the physical reactions much better today than they could back then. So it's very safe. So it's the kind of thing where you have to go to Mexico or to British Columbia to get it. But it's you could call it an immunotherapy, but it's something that raises the metabolism because it's a type of hyperthermia. Hyperthermia means high heat or raising the body's temperature. Cancer cells cannot survive a fever. So hyperthermia is often an artificially induced fever. They use hyperthermia chambers, and this is done a lot in Germany. There are two different journals in German about hyperthermia. They use it with natural protocols. They use it with chemotherapy. They use it with radiation. It enhances every therapy because it in itself is a legitimate treatment. There's a hyperthermia center that uses radiation down in Los Angeles. And recently at MD Anderson in Houston, they're doing research there with hyperthermia. So that raises the metabolism and helps to destroy everything and increase drainage. I think that these types of anyone that wants to use an alternative for healing cancer or to heal practically anything, it's the ultimate detox. Because Gerson said the purpose of this therapy is to regenerate the liver, to restore liver function, and to restore the body's inflammatory response to where it can mount a febrile response again. So when the body can like raise a fever, and that's if you're getting metabolism stimulants like thyroid hormone and niacin, and you clean out the connective tissue and clear out the liver, the body will regenerate itself. You have to create those conditions. And a Gerson therapy will take anywhere from 18 to 24 months. And, you know, it's worked with people at very late stages. But in the past, they preferred not to take people who had had chemotherapy because there was less to work with in terms of immune strength. So I feel like those are a good foundation for anyone. And, you know, I do five-day cleanses myself, and I'll do them with juices and coffee enemas and steamed vegetables just for health maintenance. You know, I'm 60. I want to live for a while, and it gets to be more work to stay healthy and vital as you get older. But this is part of the work, and it's nothing new either. People used to feast and fast. Today we feast, right? Three squares. That's how you live, three squares. Well, back in the old days, people would fast for up to 6 weeks. As recently as the early 1900s, Russian people would fast all the way from Michaelmas to the first day of Christmas. They fast about 6 weeks on water. First day of Christmas, they'd steam some cracked wheat, put some honey on it, and break the fast and begin celebrating Christmas. And then, of course, there's Lent. People used to fast during Lent. Clean house. They would also feast. They'd slaughter the fatted calf, get out the jugs of wine, and they'd party for days at a time, too. It's called full-spectrum living. But all we do is fast, and we get congested and bloated in the process. Did you know that obesity is the second worst risk factor for cancer after tobacco? Another category of cancer treatment I call the Ionic school of thought. And we're getting into more exotic territory here, but there was a French scientist that was working with blood, saliva, and urine, and he was testing the pH and the redox potential and the electrical resistance of blood, saliva, and urine, and finding these parameters, and found that he could diagnose cancer risk, could diagnose thrombotic risk by looking at these three factors. P people with a high cancer risk have a high blood pH, so the blood gets more alkaline as we get older. But the connective tissue will become more acidic. It's accumulating more waste, right? So it becomes more acidic. I called it submolecular biology because pH is your protons or positive charge. Redox potential is your oxidation. Electrons are negative charge. And resistance is conductivity, so it's positive charge, negative charge, and the flow between them. What's more basic than that? And he would find that you know, all the vegetables were antioxidant and low pH, and so they would help keep the blood alkalinity down and help the connective tissue to clear. Well, the most recent, in the 30s, there was one by William F. Koch, who developed super powerful antioxidants that were healing cancer and chronic viral infections right and left. He had eminent scientists and doctors testifying to the FDA that this stuff is the greatest stuff since sliced bread, and they didn't approve it. So the government of Brazil invited Koch to come live there and fully funded laboratory for the rest of his life. So Koch moved to Rio de Janeiro and lived the rest of his life there. So the Koch remedies have fallen into obscurity, but they were ionic because they would work right at the cellular level, get the mitochondria going, clear out all the junk, and create a chain reaction of antioxidant activity. It would be not just an antioxidant, but a chain reaction that would go through. And the same way a virus infects cell to cell to cell to cell, this would disinfect them cell to cell to cell to cell. So that's hard to find. There are people around that still do it. The next one is by an Italian doctor called Simoncini, who's using sodium bicarbonate to treat cancer. Injected orally, he's brushing iodine and magnesium chloride on breast tumors and recommending an alkalizing diet and getting remarkable successes with it. And I hear of people here and there. I don't have direct experience with this, but I've talked to people who say they've gotten well. I gave a lecture in France a year ago, and there are a lot of doctors there in the audience, and they said, we know Simoncini, and we've seen some of his patients, and you know, they validated it for me. And it's a fairly simple kind of thing. Sodium bicarbonate, of course, is an alkalizing agent, and the bicarbonate ion is found in the pancreas. It's the primary cation in the small intestine, which is an alkaline environment. So there's the hydrochloric acid and sodium bicarbonate, or an acid-base pairing in the stomach and the small intestine. And then one that I want to be sure to tell you about is called German New Medicine. German New Medicine was developed by an MD named Reichgerd Hamer, H-A-M-E-R, who was traumatized, to say the least, by the tragic death of his son. A year later, he had prostate cancer. He, in his mind, connected the two together and went through a healing process and came to terms with his grievous loss and healed himself of this trauma, and the cancer went away. Well, he developed this into a methodology of working with cancer patients, and come hell or high water, find that core trauma, and come hell or high water, resolve it right now. We're going to do it. He also has developed a very controversial method of looking at a brain scan, and from the brain scan claims to be able to tell you what part of the body the cancer is in, and even what type of trauma it was. Of course, this is getting into guesswork. It's not a pure science, not that any pure science really exists anyway. But they have a training program for professionals to learn German New Medicine. And there are some other elements. There are certainly lifestyle elements. No one in the natural cancer or the alternative cancer therapy business is going to ignore sugar and heavily cooked meats and that kind of thing. And I'm sure there are supplements that are used. But the core of the treatment is getting rid of that trauma. So that's the essence of what's in the book that's coming out in French. I'm probably going to publish it in English sometime, possibly next year. There are also some interesting methods for tumor reduction. As I mentioned earlier, conventional therapy is all about getting rid of the tumor. Well, getting rid of the tumor is a good thing. It's a toxic depot. It's a repository of immune system draining stuff. And I've seen people have cancer surgery where they came out of it transformed because they'd gotten rid of this toxic focus. So getting rid of tumors is a good thing. But there are some interesting new ways to do it now. With prostate tumors, there is an ultrasound method that's not approved in this country, but there are a few urologists that are doing it here and there. But it's used widely in Europe and in South America, and I think some other countries. And so it's a high-intensity and high-frequency ultrasound treatment where there's a rectal insertion, and the cancer cells are killed, but the normal cells are left alone. And it's also partly a hyperthermia because the ultrasound is high intensity and it raises the temperature. So the cancer cells are more sensitive to the temperature. There's a type of phototherapy, which is light therapy. There are a few of those, but there's one that's being done in Ireland where they intravenously introduce light-sensitive chemicals that are preferentially taken up by the malignant cells. So the malignant cells in particular are stuffed with this chemical. Then they shine a light over the tumor, and the photosensitive chemicals release singlet oxygen, which is, normal oxygen is O2, two oxygen atoms make an oxygen molecule. Singlet is single O's, and the singlet oxygen destroys the abnormal cells when they shine this light on it. There is electronic treatment that was actually developed over 100 years ago. There were electromagnetic treatments and electronic treatments for tumor reduction that were all quackery by the 1920s when the pharmaceutical companies bought the medical schools. And so, you know, now we talk about black boxes and electronics, you know, like, ooh, that's, you know, fake stuff. But it was revived in the 1970s by a Swedish scientist who was actually on one of the Nobel committees for medicine. And he said that there were biologically closed electric circuits, BCEC for short, and he began electronically reducing tumors. At first he was given 7 or 8 very old advanced stage lung cancer patients, which were tricky because to insert into the tumor you had to prevent the lung from collapsing. So he put this electric charge through the needle and shrank the tumors. Just shrank them down, they became fibrotic. And these guys were living. They were all men. They were living for, you know, months longer than expected. So Nordenstrom died in the night. His name was Bjorn Nordenstrom. He died in the 1990s. But there are a small group of doctors that have taken up his work. There's a doctor in China that's done incredible work. You know, when they do studies in China, it's like 800 patients came, you know, on April 14th. You know, it's like our studies here are like 70 people, 60 people. But they've had success with hundreds of patients reducing the tumors electronically. Now, in this case, I don't think they necessarily do anything with lifestyle. They say, come on in, and they'll take the tumors down. And there's a doctor in Austria that's also doing the work, and there are a couple in South America once again. Little pockets here and there are doing this. There are also plant-based ways of reducing tumor. Laetril is actually quite good. There's an authority on alternative cancer treatment named Ralph Moss, PhD, who worked at Sloan Kettering. And, you know, he's a research scientist, and he was looking through the files and said, oh, look at this. Look at these Laetril. Oh, these are good. Well, the Laetril stuff really worked. Hey, everybody, look at this. I said, shut up. Put it back. Close the drawer. Leave it alone. So he quit. Said, this is complete lack of integrity. I can't live with this. So now he has newsletters and information about alternative cancer therapies. Laetril is good. Venus's flytrap is good. There's something called chelidonium that's used intravenously. And then there's hyperthermia. So I've outlined for you my English language book and my French book. The only other material in there is how to deal with symptoms. There's something here about how to deal with, you know, nausea, hair loss, all these types of things. And in the book in France, there are tables of supplements that you can use to offset the negative effects of various chemotherapy agents, chemical by chemical. That's not in this book, but that I'll bring that out eventually. So I'd share with you what I want to share tonight. You're welcome to ask questions or talk about anything that's on your mind.
Do you use this primarily just for cancer patients, or you have tried it with others? You mentioned like chronic fatigue syndrome at one point.
Do I use what?
You are a consultant, a health consultant.
As a practitioner, right? Yeah. I work with what people want to work with. Sometimes I try to help people find resources offshore. And, you know, in the state of California, it's a felony to treat cancer with anything other than chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. So what I do basically is counseling on immune system building, helping with pain, helping with side effects. It's very important for anyone with a cancer challenge to take full responsibility for it, because anybody that can help you is, you know, hands-off in terms of being on the record with it. That's just the regulatory environment that we live in. But I do recommend cleansing for all kinds of health problems, because, you know, like I was saying, there are no magic bullets, but everything has probably worked for somebody. If you want to use Laetril or Venus's flytrap or whatever, magic coenzyme Q10 is a good one, any one of these magic potions, you've got to create an environment where it can work. And that requires, you know, the exercise, the diet changes, the detoxification, identifying dietary irritants, and, you know, looking at any kind of emotional, psycho-spiritual problems. It's all of those things. And I do consulting on that basis. But most of what I do is writing and consulting with companies, spas, hospitals, clinics, that type of thing. But I do some consulting with people here. Did you have some?
Yes. First, I need a little pause. Just a little. It's an awful lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever hear I think it's a native practice in Africa, where they say if the individual is ill, cure the village, heal the village,
yeah.
Heal the village.
Mm.
I have a very deep-seated belief that there is a certain energy field in which cancer will not grow, and there is a certain energy field in which cancer will grow, and that we culturally hold in place that energy field where cancer will randomly appear in our membership. And I believe that energy field has to do with language. And I believe that our language actually generates the energy field, instructs and informs the cells in our bodies and in each other's bodies. And I heard Judy Barry speak. She was the famous Earth Firster. I heard her speak many years ago, and I told the person who was sitting next to me that she was giving herself cancer and she wasn't going to live. And the next thing I heard about her some years later was that she had died of cancer, and she absolutely clear-cut the whole space with a kind of vocalizing that seemed to aggress. And I've since looked at the vocal function, the voice, and I really believe that a primal use of the voice has to do with managing fear, managing stress, so that when we are vocalizing, you're actually putting our body on a state of alert when we're using the voice, and we keep our voice, the body on us. And I think that culturally that this is what we do to all of our members, is our bodies are on this state of alert, just constantly. And just for a sense of relief, I invented this sign. It means pause. So that now I can pause myself in the middle of a sentence. And when I do it, I feel a shift. I feel a very profound energetic shift in my body into a space that I had not experienced before I had this. Mm-hmm. And so I am just looking at energy field, the energy field generated by language, mm-hmm. and the games that fear can play. And you were speaking of trauma. Language, when we're using language to manage trauma, we're actually still holding that trauma in place. And if we can manage to move to a different space, to a blank canvas, then we can distance ourselves from the trauma. But mm-hmm. but traumas are very tricky, and they have like egos, and they have a way of hiding.
They have almost an independent life. This is a really good time to take a pause since I'm finished. But but you made some really interesting points. You know, there is a lot of information here, but that's certainly not to say that there are no more mysteries. There are profound mysteries, and the mysteries are in this realm of the spiritual, of the homeopathic potentizations, of the neurolinguistics. And what you propose there really is kind of a micro meditation, where you stop. You know, we can say, well, meditation is when you sit quietly for 20 minutes. But meditation can be a lot of things. And I think you've come up with something very useful.
Thank you.
Anybody else have a comment or a thought?
What do you feel about the liver flush?
The liver flush is really a gallbladder flush more than anything, because you can only detoxify a certain amount of the liver at a given time. And I'm certainly I'm for it. I feel, though, that it's important to make a sustained effort with that. When we speak of the caffeine retention enema, that is, in effect, a liver and gallbladder flush that's being done several times a day. It's not as intensive as the, you know, taking the mineral salts and then the, you know, the... there's a good one you can do with the grapefruit juice and the oil too. Mm-hmm. And so these are good things, and it there's no specific way to do it right. And I try to communicate this with people that you know, you can follow a protocol or follow someone else's program, but ultimately you're going to find your own way to do it. Mm-hmm. And if that is something that fits in with it, and if it feels good to you, I'd say by all means, there's no reason not to do it. But grapefruit itself is very detoxifying. That's why you can't take it with some prescription drugs, because it'll eliminate them from the body more quickly. Mm-hmm. So let's say, well, grapefruit juice is contraindicated for this drug. But
does milk thistle help for liver detoxification?
Milk thistle is good because it not only helps to drain the liver, but it helps to regenerate new liver cells. Mm-hmm. So it does two things. And it helps relieve what's called splanchnic congestion, which means that fluids aren't circulating very well in the trunk. So, you know, milk thistle is good for a lot of things. It may not be so good when you're anxious, because it stimulates the sympathetic nervous system a little bit. Mm. But if you're feeling sluggish, it can be activating too. So I'm going to turn this back over to Rob, who's got a few more announcements, and I really appreciate your attention.
Thank you so much. So we have a couple of things. Number one, there is a donation bowl over on the counter, and we hope you will contribute to it. We share the
we share
the contents of the donation bowl with our speakers to help further their work and to help maintain this space for these sorts of events in the future. And I'll just remind you that we have some of the Whole Body Workbook for Cancer copies here in the front for you to take a look at and purchase. And I look forward to seeing you back here in the store at other times for the rest of this week for our sale and for our next events here in the store on Thursday evenings. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
That's a good one. I saw her in some. Thank you.